Hello, and welcome to the Emotional Expedition Podcast. I'm Meg Thomas, and if you want to live a more open-hearted, magical life, it all starts with your emotions. This podcast will take you on a journey, helping you to better understand, express, release, and heal your emotions. Let's get exploring. Are you ready to embark on a journey of healing, self-discovery, and embracing imperfection? Today on the podcast, we have the incredible best-selling author, Diana Lockett, of The Call to Freedom, who shares her raw and inspiring story of navigating life's challenges and learning to reconnect with the parts of herself she once denied, disowned, and shut down. Together, we delve into powerful tools and practices for emotional healing, such as meditation, energy healing, and yoga, as well as our own personal experiences and growth through these practices. We discuss the essential process of forgiveness, from generational traumas to acts of self-sabotage, and how to create space for ourselves to heal and grow. And in this heartfelt conversation, we touch on the importance of boundaries, communication, and vulnerability in our lives. Diana shares her journey as a speech pathologist, her experience of opening and closing many yoga studios, reflecting on the valuable lessons learned along the way. Don't miss this opportunity to explore the journey towards love, purpose, and healing through life's many challenges with our incredible guest, Diana Lockett. Welcome, Diana. I am so excited to have you here and have this conversation with you. I just finished your book, which is so incredibly beautiful. Of course, I'll have it in the show notes. It's called The Call to Freedom: Heal Your Pain, Awaken Your Loving Presence. And I just want to acknowledge your resilience. The way that you have shared so beautifully how you have navigated through life's ups and downs. And I think there are people out there in the world that only have like one before and after moment in their life, like one big trauma or struggle or challenge. I am not one of those. And after reading your book, I recognize very much that you are not one of those either, that you have had many, many different kinds of challenges throughout your life, and just this beautiful way that you imperfectly go through them and learn and grow. And I use that word imperfect because you speak of it in your book, in the sense of getting stuck, like the perfectionism keeping us stuck, the challenge of that. And this is the reality of healing. And these are the kind of conversations, and these are the people I'm most excited to talk to, are the people that can go through life and acknowledge the messiness and do it imperfectly and just keep going. It's like you are one of those people that gets knocked down 7 times and stands up 8. Like, that's what I was walking away with. So please, we are so excited to have you here. Welcome, Diana. How are you today?
Thank you. First off, thank you so much for having me here, Meg. It's such an honor to be in your presence. Thank you for reading my book. It means a lot to me. And I'll elaborate on that in a little bit. And I'm great. I'm here. I'm present. I'm excited to have this conversation with you. And so again, I'm truly honored to be on your show. Thank you.
Thank you. Will you talk to us about how it all started? Will you talk about your childhood and what kind of child you were? What were your emotions like at that time in your life?
Yeah, that's a really big question. My childhood was complicated. You know, really, my life has been complicated in a lot of ways. And it seems like every new challenge, the word that comes up is it's complicated. On one hand, I grew up with three siblings, so my mother had four girls under the age of 2 and 2 months.
Wow.
Like she was busy and didn't have the capacity to deal with that. So my mother turned to Valium, which was an antidepressant that knocked her out and kept her sanity. That was how she managed and coped. And so what happened was my sisters and I were really left to tend to ourselves. And we were really good little girls, because if we weren't good little girls, we were met with my dad's wrath at the end of the day, which was, wait till your father gets home. And hours and hours and hours and hours later, we could be awoken in the middle of the night and hit with a strap on our bare bottoms or across the face. So I had moments of real contentment and joy in the presence of my sisters, where we bonded really strongly. And, you know, if you know about trauma survival and trauma bonding, we really had that. We found our joy together. We played freely. We didn't have a lot of conditions placed on our play, but there were a lot of conditions placed on how we behaved, how we looked, and what we said. The word is that I came out of the womb really chatty. And so much so that my twin sister didn't talk until she was almost four, because I talked for her. Now, communication has been my life purpose. It's been my career. It's so interesting when I look back and I follow the breadcrumbs of my life. And yet there came a time where, when I was about 7 years old, I would put on performances, I would recite poetry, I would sing songs, and then I would talk. And then when I was 7 years old, I got a set of chatter teeth, these little wind-up chatter teeth, and everybody thought it was really funny, and they laughed. And I remember the feeling of my just immense deflation and shutting down at that moment, where I received the message, my little girl interpreted the message that she was too much, and so she shut down. And I have all different experiences where that showed up in my life in a way that didn't serve me or the experience. I diminished my voice. I didn't speak up. I didn't have boundaries. And all of this continued through up until my 30s, where I was finally able to recognize there was something in me that was rattling, that needed expression. And what it needed was for me to be in a relationship with the parts of myself that I had denied, disowned, shut down, because they weren't welcome. The parts of me that could be a little bit over the top, the parts of me that had a wide range of emotional, energetic expressions and feelings, I lived in this narrow bandwidth. I was happy, sad, and that was it. There was no room in my house for anger. Anger wasn't safe. There was no room in my house for disappointment. There was no room in my house for jealousy. Like, there was, you know, hundreds of other emotional ranges that I never had experience with. And so growing up in my teens and early adult, life was really confusing for me, because I only saw life through these two lenses. If I'm not happy, I'm sad. If I'm not sad, I'm happy. And there was nothing in between. And it didn't allow me to skillfully navigate relationships. What happened then is I learned to really keep to myself. I didn't know how to be vulnerable, which meant I didn't have many friends. I didn't really hold on to relationships and share authentically. All of this until the age of 32, where it happened to coincide with when my daughter was born. And when my daughter was born, something in me, and I wasn't clear at the time what it was, started to rattle. It was like little knocks, like, wake up, wake up, wake up, feel this fully, be present to this. And so I went on a journey of really working through and cultivating a wider range of emotional, energetic experiences, feeling it all, learning how to be present, because my story is I didn't even know how to be present at the time, or what that meant. And I allowed myself 25 years now of really deep, immersive experiences that, you know, some might say I was on a healing journey. I believe we're all on a healing journey. Like you said, I've just had like 7 or 8 or 10 knockdowns that have given me an opportunity to work a little bit more.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. I think so many of us can relate to having a moment in our childhoods where we integrated a belief about ourselves that wasn't true. And then we hold on to it. So if I got it right, this happened, you know, around 7 years old, and you kept that story until you were 30, 32 before you started to really.
Yeah, probably even like closer to 40. Yeah. So I started looking at my energetic system, my emotional system, my beliefs and my thoughts. All of that started coming into my awareness when I was 32, but it took me several years to fully understand it. Mm-hmm. And there's a part of me that will say, I didn't really fully understand it until 3 years ago. Oh, and this book that you speak of that I wrote and released April 1st, it was 7 years of writing. And I got to around 2018 and I stopped writing. I didn't know what else I was supposed to write. I didn't have the last four chapters of the book. I kept asking myself, is that it? Is that how it ends? And yet I knew it wasn't. And it was because I had to live through the last 3 years, which for me was the integration of my entire life, culminated, understood, and then loved in that moment, to be able to complete the book in the last four chapters of the book.
Wow. What was that process like writing the book?
The first 8 or 9 chapters were, I wanted to say, part of me wants to say robotic. They weren't robotic because I was feeling it all as I was writing it. And of course, when one writes a book and they go through editing processes and editing processes and editing processes, I'm rereading my book continuously. So I'm continuously reliving those experiences. But each time there's a sense of I'm embracing the experience more. And more importantly, I'm embracing that little girl who had that experience. And so I've done a lot of work on attachments, and I know my attachment style and how I show up in relationships, and I know my triggers and I know my hooks. Like, I'm really self-aware that way. But writing this book and then having to go back and reread and reread and reread allowed me to really awaken to a compassion to the younger parts of myself that she didn't receive when she was growing up. And growing up, like all the way to 3 years ago, growing up well into her 50s, I had to give myself the compassion that there's a part of me that wanted to receive it from others, but they weren't able to provide it. And so I learned how to really self-nurture, self-love, self-reparent, and self-parent, depending on what the moment was. Mm-hmm. So it's been an interesting journey. Writing is easy for me. Communication's my jive. It's pretty effortless for me. I knew that my book was meant to be written as authentically as possible. I didn't really hold back on any of the experiences. Sometimes I cringe a little bit. I go into some vulnerability hits where it's like, ooh, I put that in there. People are going to know that about me. And yet there isn't a part of me that wanted to hold back, because I have a really strong belief that my book is medicine for someone else. Yeah. And, you know, some of those someones contact me and they tell me how it changed their lives. Some of them are local and they want to meet with me. And I love that I can do that. It allows me to move in a way outside of my story. So it's no longer about me, poor me, pity me. And it's about really seeing how my life has cultivated in a way that has been for the evolution of not just my soul, but for all beings, when I can choose to share vulnerably. Mm. And it is super vulnerable.
Yeah. This is my belief system. I don't believe that I would have gone through the challenges and struggles I have if there wasn't a higher purpose for it. And so a part of who I am as well is, once I have learned something or integrated or healed that part, I need to, it's not even a want, it's a need to share it. And
it's a yearning or a longing, right? Like, it's a yearning that you can't deny. I get it. Yeah.
Yeah. And when you talk about your family in the book, in the challenges of growing up, you so beautifully share, which is another one of my beliefs as well, is everyone was doing the best they could. Your mom, your dad doing the best that they both could. And yet, as an adult, you found yourself having to go through a reparenting process. Can you share any tools or tips for somebody that might find themselves in a similar type of position?
Yeah, for sure. So my quote, and I know you're going to ask me at the end what my quote is, and so I'm going to give it to you right now. One of them is the quote from my book, which is that everyone does the best they can, given their model of reality of the world, their capacity, and their resources. And sometimes our model of the world is not great. Like, until I knew better, I didn't know better. Mm-hmm. Sometimes our capacity and our resources are really low. And so when I remember that, and I have to remind myself when I find myself in a situation where I feel I've been betrayed or somebody is weaponizing some anger towards me, I remember that statement. Now, there's a time and a place for that. Not everybody will necessarily be able to call up that quote and believe it, but it's a practice. So it became a practice that I really wanted to cultivate. And it's a practice that then leads to immense radical forgiveness. And forgiveness is about releasing the pain and tension from your heart so that you can live wholeheartedly. The tools and the practices that I cultivated, I mean, 25 years ago, I started doing meditation and I started doing energy healing and I became an energy healer. Now, meditation and I was interesting because I thought I thought I was doing it wrong because I couldn't still my thoughts. And I felt like I was going to vomit every time I sat down to meditate. Mm. And I didn't feel any comfort in meditation that I saw yogis and yogins have in their meditation. So I thought I was doing something wrong. Let me just clear that up right now. If you are in meditation and you start to notice there's thoughts coming through, that's called mastery in meditation. It's not about stilling your thoughts completely, but observing your thoughts, observing the sensations in your body. So now I know I was doing it really well, but at the time I was very much in judgment, or I did the opposite. I used meditation to escape life. And you'll read about that in the first couple of chapters where I used meditation to avoid dealing with my first marriage when it was crumbling. I could go to meditate for 2-3 hours a night. And in those times, he couldn't disturb me because I was meditating. Door was closed. I'm on my stool. Music's on. Candles lit. So it was a great escape. So we can do meditation sometimes for different reasons. That was my first tool. Then a couple of years later, I was introduced to yoga. And yoga and I didn't have a good relationship either when I started. I thought it was I was a competitive athlete. I was doing duathlons and long distance running. I thought it was the hardest thing I'd ever done. I couldn't understand how people were smiling. I didn't understand why they were talking to each other after class when I just couldn't even stand to look at them. Like, I had a really negative relationship with this practice. And I was so competitive, I came back to it. I said, okay, I'm going to beat yoga. Yoga thinks it's going to beat me, but I am going to beat yoga's butt. And soon, it didn't take long before I started softening in the practice, feeling my body, deepening my relationship to my breath, letting my tears come, didn't even know what they were for, didn't need to know. I didn't realize I was brought up in a very traumatic environment. I didn't have that language. I didn't have that context. I thought everybody was neglected or abused growing up. And I can use those words now. It took me a long time to be able to use those words. But I had really the two most significant traumas, and neglect probably a little bit worse than abuse as a young child for me, because I wanted my mommy to see me. I wanted her to listen to me. I wanted her to wake up. And so that had a big impact on me. Eventually, I stuck with yoga and I deepened into a really beautiful relationship with my body, with my energetic body, with my physical body, with my emotional body, with my thoughts. I became a yoga teacher and really quickly started doing yoga teacher training programs. So I opened up my own school and academy. And I saw how other people were coming to this experience and really melting their defenses. The defenses are there for a reason. They protected me when I was growing up and didn't know how to navigate and feel safe in the world. I had to armor my heart. Mm-hmm. I had to have defensive strategies. And in fact, as you read in the book, at 32, I was called out by a friend who said, oh, Diana's so lovely. She's so accomplished. She's so professional, but she's such an ice queen. And that's really what started me on my journey. It's like, holy crap, I'm an ice queen. And why am I an ice queen? And do I want to be an ice queen? And can I start to open my heart? So it was about 10 years of this on and off relationship with meditation, energy work, yoga, and breath work. And then in my 40s and into my 50s, I started doing really deep shadow work. And shadows are the disowned parts of ourselves. I started reclaiming the parts of myself that I didn't even know were missing, but I knew there was something missing. They were just so deeply buried inside me, I didn't allow them to come through. And because of it, I judged other people and I didn't access all parts of myself. So I started doing my shadow work, found myself in a community in Amsterdam where I learned to be a circle facilitator and find immense discomfort in circles that allowed myself to be in the discomfort. And that eventually, fast forward, took me to COVID, where at that point, I knew my relationship with my second husband, who I love and still do. My relationship was in trouble. We were not communicating. There were some violations of boundaries. Things were not going well. And when COVID hit, and our entire province, Ontario at the time, was shut down. Schools were shut down. Work was shut down. Studios were shut down. There was nobody allowed to communicate. They weren't allowed to see each other. It was all just through Zoom. He moved out and he didn't move back in. And within a few months, my cat died, my dad died, and my daughter moved across the country. So I found myself with this incredible opportunity to go deep and to ask myself, what do I need to feel better? What do I need to be more present? What am I being called to? And this is where the last 3 years allowed me to write my last four chapters. And they were rooted in the concepts of loving presence, loving what is, forgiveness, integration, and my last chapter, which is called You Are Me Lovingly Disguised as You. And what I had to learn to do in those 3 years is to surrender to all the emotional ranges that I was experiencing. I was done trying to push them away. I was a yogini who loved to feel good and smile, but I didn't really like to feel anger and disappointment and frustration and abandonment and all those things. And I let myself be there. I let myself feel it. And where I came to was this opportunity where I could feel good feeling bad. And I say that cautiously because I don't believe in the judgment of good or bad for emotions. I believe all emotions are simply the body's experience of the world. And that all emotions, when witnessed through an open heart, I'm going to call them become joy. So joy is the experience of witnessing all emotions through an open heart without judgment, without trying to push it away, without trying to make it wrong. And yet it's not the way I was brought up. And it's not the way most of us are conditioned. We still hold on to this is good and this is bad. Let's get rid of the bad and let's just turn towards the good. And then when we're not feeling good, we think there's something wrong with us. When really, it's simply an opportunity to turn to your heart. Feel what is. This is the reparenting and love it. Sometimes I had to go into my heart and find a little girl. Sometimes I asked her how old she was. I asked her what she needed. And I did that with her. So sometimes it might have been rocking on the floor, just holding myself. Sometimes it was literally having a full-on temper tantrum, putting on Alanis Morissette and screaming her lyrics at the top of my voice, going to the river and sitting and crying. And I still do all those things today. Sometimes it's journaling. Sometimes it's an embodied meditation. I don't typically do like a mindful meditation in those moments because it's not about my mind. It's about really integrating and loving the experience that my body's having in that moment. And if I can nurture that, eventually my narratives change, my thoughts change, and it changes everything.
Thank you.
You mentioned that forgiveness has become a big part of your journey, especially these last 3 years, while collectively the world was experiencing COVID and this time, but you also were experiencing the loss of your cat, the loss of your father, and then the loss of your marriage all during that time as well. What does forgiveness mean to you?
So the quote that I used earlier, everyone's doing the best they can given their model of reality, their capacity, and their resources. Forgiveness is remembering that. Mm-hmm. And in my book, in the chapter on forgiveness, I talk about how my first experience and practice of forgiveness was to forgive my father for the physical abuse. And it took a few years to do that. It wasn't a quick journey. This is back in maybe about 10 years ago. It wasn't a fast journey. And I needed to distance myself from him. So I actually didn't visit him for a little while until I felt that I could be in my sovereignty in his presence, which was really important for me to stay in a state of acceptance and forgiveness. Forgiveness doesn't mean what he did was ever okay. Forgiveness means that I no longer want to keep that heavy clay or obstacle between our hearts, that I'm choosing to release it. And I'm so grateful I did, because when my dad did pass away, he was alone in a nursing home in Montreal where COVID went rampant in the nursing homes. And although I didn't get to see him, I felt complete with our relationship. I had seen him a few months earlier and I felt complete. The harder part of forgiveness for me was to forgive my mom because I saw her as a victim. So part of the work on forgiveness with my mom was to go back and do some work on some of the generational traumas that were passed down through her. And I could see where she did the best she could given her model, her capacity, and her resources. And I went back to her mother and her mother. So I had to go back and do some generational healing, which is simply, if someone says, what does that mean? Holding space for all those parts of them that are now in my DNA and loving those parts of me. That's how we do it. Then I had to do some forgiveness to I had a whole list of people in my book. I was sexually assaulted and someone had betrayed me, stolen all of my money. My first husband who insisted I have an abortion when I didn't want to have an abortion. Like, there was a lot of forgiveness to do. And then it came down to one person left, and that was me. And that was really deep healing work to be able to remember the parts of my life where I was very imperfect and forgiving myself for those moments where I could then tell myself, I did the best I could. And I'd love your audience to hear this and say this to yourself. I did the best I could, given my model, my capacity, and more resources. Because if we can't self-forgive, it will be difficult to move forward with an open, clear heart. It will show up in relationships. It will show up as self-sabotage. It will show up a lot. So my own self-forgiveness was probably the part that these last 3 years I was really able to immerse myself into. And I'm still on that journey. Yeah. I think that we're always on that journey. There's always something else that comes up. It's like, oh man, I didn't show up at the best then. I could have done this differently. And here's where I get to do it differently. I now know how to repair. So when I mess up, I can take responsibility. And I can say, oh, that wasn't my highest self showing up. I'm really sorry.
Yes.
So I'll give you an example, really recent, like yesterday.
Oh, okay.
So here we are. We are in British Columbia. I'm so sorry for those of you in the US. Canada is sharing our smokes from our fires with you. Really apologize. We have immense fires happening here that are out of control. My daughter is supposed to get married in 3 days. On the island of Vancouver. We live on the mainland. Didn't think it was a big deal. We've got our ferries booked. We've got our drive booked. We've got the accommodations booked. She's got a wedding planner. Everything's organized there. And we find out yesterday that there's been a really big fire that's out of control and debris from the fire has landed on the one and only road to get us to that area on the island. And so at first they said, it's not passable. Nobody can go. And it could be up to 6 days before they get an engineer in to evaluate the integrity of the road. So I went into mom mode. Oh my goodness. I know my daughter's panicking. How can I help? I called a friend. She lives on a different island. She said in 2 hours, she can have a whole wedding planned for me if we want to do that, if we want to go in that direction. And she messages me as she's booking accommodations. She's booking restaurants. She's booking a venue. She's booking a minister. She's got the flowers. She's got everything set up. And so I send a message to my daughter thinking I'm helping and said, you know, sweetie, if things don't work out, we can do this here. You can do this here. It can be all set up. Just tell me and it's done. And she got really angry with me, which wasn't what I expected. I went in as mom trying to fix things. She didn't want to be fixed.
Yeah.
In that moment, she was having the conversation she needed to have with the people she needed to have conversations with to see what the implications of this were going to be. And she just needed me to be present, calm, and hold space for whatever she brought, which was really big energy. And I had to say, wow, I'm really sorry. I overstepped. I came in to fix. You didn't want to be fixed. You were figuring this out. You're 26 years old. You can figure this out. Mm-hmm. And so I need to learn to take responsibility and do the repair. Another parent, and I do parenting coaching, another parent might have reacted very differently. Well, I'm just trying to help. Like, you're so ungrateful, yada, yada, yada. That's not at all where I go. Where I go is, you're right. That's not what you need from me right now. I'm really sorry. Mm-hmm. That's the repair. Yeah.
I love that story. Thank you. Yeah, this continues to show up in my life as well, is sometimes we just want to be seen or heard. We don't want someone to fix. And with my best friend now, we have this pact with each other that there are times when we will call each other and the first sentence we'll say is like, okay, are you available to hold space? That's usually the first thing is, can you hold this for me? And the next sentence will be, I don't want you to fix anything. Can you just hear me? And being able to go into it that way, because that's all we want. And one of my favorite Brené Brown quotes is, I'm not here to be right. I'm here to get it right. And that's what I just heard in that modeling of being a parent, is you're not going to get it right 100% of the time. And it's not about getting it right from the get-go. It's about once we understand better to be able to make amends or to say, I'm really sorry, I didn't hear you. And of course, and you know how to help her in the sense of, if she does decide to go in a different direction with the wedding, you'll be right there to do that part too. Yeah,
that's really beautiful. Absolutely. And they did, they opened up a logging road, which is really sketchy. I'm not sure, you know, how I feel about driving on it, but it's adding 3 hours to the drive, but that's what we're going to do. We're going to actually go ahead and try. And I love how you called your friend and you first thing you say is, do you have the capacity? You used a different word, but do you have the capacity to listen to me? And that's what I do as well, especially with my daughter, who I know is very busy. She's doing her PhD. She's planning a wedding. She and her partner have a business. If I need to talk, I will call her and say, do you have capacity to listen? And if she says no, I have to be okay with that.
Yeah.
But without asking it and just starting to talk and projecting myself onto her creates tension in the relationship. So for those of you listening, pay attention to this, because that tension then builds up as withhold energy, withheld conversations, closed down hearts, guarded minds. Oh no, they're calling me, or they're calling me to complain again, or what's up now? And if you just say those 3-4 words, do you have the capacity? Do you have capacity? My daughter sometimes will say yes, and sometimes she'll say no. But my fiance does let me put him on the phone. And he's always really good. And he's learning boundaries. This is boundaries. This is being able to say, no, I don't have capacity, as boundaries. And we have to be okay with that. Because if we get okay with listening and hearing boundaries, we get better at using them as well. And as children, I'll speak for myself, I was not taught how to have boundaries because I didn't have access to my voice. No was never an option for me. And so I didn't learn how to say no to anything in my life. And I didn't know how to say yes to me.
I love that. And I love in your book is this beautiful blend of memoir with the tools to actually help. And so I remember you talking about in the book about no, and you phrased it so beautifully of just start with something simple. If you struggle to set boundaries, if you struggle to say no to people, maybe it's out of fear of disappointing someone. I think you used the example of start by saying, no, I don't want any more food. When, you know, someone comes to pass food, I was like, that is so brilliant, is just take the small baby step. Or the person at the cash register who's always like, would you like to, you know, donate a dollar today, or whatever the thing they're asking you to do at the cash register now, practice saying no there with a stranger. And see how that feels.
And you could say, no, thank you.
Yeah.
You could say it with a thank you, but you don't have to give an explanation. And as soon as one starts explaining their no, they're giving away their power. They're making that no negotiable.
Yes.
Most of my clients come to see me. I work one-on-one with clients. I do leadership consulting as well, but my one-on-one clients come to see me because there's something in their life that's just not feeling great. And let me tell you, 80% of the time, we're working on boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
And then the rest of the time, we're working on letting go.
Yeah.
Walking with open palms, releasing ours to hold on to.
Now, I know from a previous conversation with you that you have done so much brilliant work as a speech pathologist. And what's the importance of people being able to understand us or using our voice in these ways? What have you seen through that work of just, and it's so fascinating because of you sharing about your childhood and a part of you, you know, being this chatterbox, as you said, being this one who would speak and communicate, and that is who you are in writing a book, of course, another form of communication, but even within yourself that got shut down for so long. So I'd love to hear what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah. So let me just make sure I'm understanding the question. So the question is around the importance of being able to communicate so we can be heard.
Yeah.
Is that your question?
Yeah. And I don't know exactly what your work looks like as a speech pathologist. I just know it's made up a big part of your life as well. And I just am trying to connect this thread of your own story and how you ended up working in that way as well.
Yeah. Fantastic. Well, first of all, I want to acknowledge that I went to Syracuse University, which is where you're from as well. And so I don't get to meet a lot of people from Syracuse. And did my master's there quite a long time ago and worked as a speech language pathologist, which is a fantastic career. I loved that career. And I worked primarily for the last 20 years in the field of autism and nonverbal communication. So sometimes I get to work with kiddos whose only way of communicating is to use their eye gaze and blink or use their eye gaze to activate a screen to communicate for them. Or they have a big button and they hit it to say no, because the alternative is they're hitting you. And so working with these nonverbal kids, I've worked with verbal kids as well, but these nonverbal kids have taught me so much about the power of presence. If I'm not present, if I come in with my projected agenda, if I come in talking more than listening to what they're telling me nonverbally, then I'm likely going to get hit, kicked, bit, or spit on, which are the four things that happen quite often. So I've had to really, or chosen to sit back a little bit and observe more than project what my impulses or what my agenda might be, or other people's agenda, because parents in schools have their agendas as well. And it's allowed me to get really curious about the power of communication, verbal and nonverbal, and the energy exchange that happens through that. And of course, as a child who shut down her voice going into a career, it was really only when I was writing my book that I followed those breadcrumbs and saw, wow, I didn't have access to a voice, but I'm helping literally tens of thousands of people access their voice. From nonverbal kids, giving them one button that says no, giving them a way to say yes or no with their eye gaze, giving them an opportunity to ask for help, something that most women today and men have a really hard time doing. And that's my goal with these nonverbal kids, because if they can ask for help, they can receive help. It's part of, like, they have taught me so much. And then a big part of the group that I've worked with as well have been adult stutterers or adult people who have accent needs. So they're in a managerial, a leadership, a speaker role, and they're bringing an accent, which, you know, is usually lovely, but unfortunately it's getting in the way of their ability to be understood from their team or from their audience. So I do some accent reduction. I retired from that career 2 years ago when I moved to British Columbia from Ontario. And I thought I was done, and I loved it, and I thought I was done. And I got here in this little tiny mountain town of 20,000 people doing yoga, because I teach a little bit of yoga, I do some leadership consulting, some one-on-one coaching, and people would come up to me after yoga class where I was just a student, and they'd say, I hear you're a speech-language pathologist. And I would say, where did you hear that? Because I have not told anybody. Like, is it branded on my forehead? Where is the evidence of that? And so the message was really clear. We need you. Our community is desperate for speech-language pathologists. Parents are driving 2 hours to get services for their kids. Would you consider opening up a business here? So I registered. I have to register because I'm a regulated healthcare profession. I had to go through the process of registering. I launched a private practice. And the day I launched my private practice, I called a woman who works in the school board. There are 2 speech-language pathologists here in the school system. That's it. I come from a group of 40 speech-language pathologists, so there's only 2, small area. And I said, I'm open for business if you have private clients. She said, okay, but I'm also retiring in June. Do you want my job? And what's really cool about my life is I've never applied for a job. Mm. I've been very blessed in that opportunities come to me, and I could say, I'm receptive. The universe, you know, when I stay open, the universe provides. There's abundance always. I got so lit up when she said that. I said, you know what? I do. I realized I missed being in that environment and delivering my skills in that particular way. So I'm actually working with the school board just part-time, doing private practice part-time, coaching part-time, speaking part-time, authoring part-time. And I'm simply saying, universe, show me the way. Yeah. Tell me where I can serve. It's all service. For me, it's all rooted in this area of communication and spirit-driven communication. Mm. And I am open to receive. And so life is interesting. And I don't know where it's going to take me, but clearly I'm meant to be continuing to serve in this way.
Yeah.
And it feels good.
Mm. I love that. And to me, I interpret that as following those intuitive nudges as well of just that next right step. And
yeah.
And because I read your book, I know that you had a business that financially ran into some challenges. And so to be able to pick up those pieces again and can just continue that over and over again is just so remarkable. Will you tell us a little bit about the yoga studio?
Did you hear that big exhale?
Yes. Yes. And you don't have to. This is always.
Well, no. This is again, you know, I didn't have to share this part of my life, and I shared because I hope that it will be medicine for someone else.
I think so. Financial struggles are something that we don't talk about and we carry so much shame about. And I myself have experienced financial struggles, and it's really hard for me to talk about that part. And so when I read in your book, I just was like, oh, this is so beautiful, the way that she shares how challenging this journey is and how she stood up again. Yeah.
Yeah, another time where I stood up. You know, I studied and I worked directly with Les Brown for several years. And Les always says, when you fall down, fall on your back, because if you can look up, you can get up. Mm. And I would love to say I fell on my back, but sometimes I fell to my knees and I just prayed. In 2010, my husband and I decided, husband at the time, that we wanted to open up a yoga studio. and we found the perfect location. And you know, you've heard this quote, if you build it, they will come, from Field of Dreams, the movie. We built the studio and we had people lined up outside the door for weeks before we opened the doors, waiting for us to open. It was so welcomed in this community. And we quickly were offered another space. So decided, okay, we'll do both. They'll be called Inspire Yoga. We will bring all of our gifts to this place and build community. And the first day that we launched and opened our doors, we made $40,000. And I felt so affirmed. This is exactly what we're meant to do. Clearly, look at the abundance that's coming through in financial, in people, in generosity of comments. Like, it was so fantastic. Media was there. And then I allowed myself to be guided by other people to make decisions that were not decisions that I truly felt were the right decisions for me or my family or the business. And we opened up two other studios. So bottom line is, in 2 years, we opened up and closed four studios. And there was a lot of shame in the closing, especially the first one, which I did as a middle of the night, close, take what I can, run, because I was so embarrassed. And then I felt so ashamed about that. The next one, I closed with no lights, no heat, and the owner coming in saying, vacate now. And I said, can you just let me do this one last class so I can be in integrity and be present for my community? And I felt really good about that. And then the last two, I also had a little bit more decision-making in how they closed. It was a really tough season because we went from being literally at the top of a mountain and feeling so on purpose to losing everything and eventually having to go through personal bankruptcy and losing everything. And not knowing how I was going to get gas in the car, how I was going to put food on the table, where I was going to work, like what life would be like. And I would love to say that my yoga practices really took me through that time, but there was a time where I shut everything that I know down and didn't even have the capacity to turn to my practices and my beliefs. And it lasted for several months. And then eventually I was able to call on the practices, my understanding of Spanda, which is the pulsation of life, that life goes and ebbs and flows. And when we fall down, we get up. And when there's a wave, it crashes and we can ride the next wave. And I pulled all of that back into my awareness. And as I did that, I was able to cultivate more strength, more resilience, more understanding, and really able to support my family through this. And I'm really proud of what I did, and I want to acknowledge that I did it with an immense masculine energy. So the masculine energy of doing,
I did.
I worked 7 days a week. I don't really love that I did that because it's not balanced, but it's what I had to do to be able to get to where I am. And just a couple of days ago, I had a conversation with my son-in-law, and I was just offering to lend them some money. And he looked at me and he said, you know, I don't know how you did it. I don't know how you went through that. I'm getting very emotional and teary now. How you did it. It was all on you. My husband was not capable of supporting us at the time. He didn't have emotional capacity, resilience. I understood. And yet I didn't feel there was an option for me to do anything other than what I did. I had to do what I did. And he says, I don't know how you did it. And oh my gosh, like the courage that it took to get up every day. And I thanked him because sometimes I forget those days. I forget how hard it was. And I go back and I read my book and it's like, oh man, that was hard. And yet I did it. And the message I really want to share, the medicine, is that we all go through hard times. Maybe I've gone through some more than others. And yet we can get through them. We can grow through them and we can feel through them, to be able to see life eventually with a different perspective. And chapter 13 talks about, in my book, talks about the three questions that my son asked me at 1:30 in the morning on April 21st, 2021. I will never forget them. His question number one was, Mom, he woke me out of a deep sleep. He said, Mom, when is life going to go back to normal? And I pondered for a bit, and I wrote about that in the book. Life was never going back to normal for us because everything had changed. his dad, my husband was gone, his sister was gone, my dad was gone, our cat was gone. We were going to have to sell our house. I didn't know what my work was going to look like. I didn't know where he'd go to school. Everything was changing. And so I spun it in, you know what, buddy? Things are changing, but we get to create what we decide our new normal is going to be. And it's going to be fun. And if it's not fun, we're going to change it so it's fun. His second question was, what is the meaning of life? And for most people, that would be really daunting at 1:30 in the morning, half asleep. But I teach this. I understand it, right? Some of this is mindset. The meaning of life is whatever you create. We get to create the meaning to our experiences. So you and I, Meg, have had experiences that have taken us to our knees. And yet we get to create a meaning that this is here in service and medicine for other people. It allows us to look and reflect with a different meaning than being in a victim state, which would be a really slippery and easy slope to go down. But I choose to create a different meaning from the experiences I've had. So my response to him is, the meaning of life is whatever you give it. And so for those of you listening, if you're going through a hard time, maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but maybe in a few weeks, months, or years, can you look back and assign a different meaning to your experience so that it's more digestible, just a little bit easier? The last question he asked is, why are we here? I know you're laughing because you read this.
I just want to meet him. I'm like, who comes up with this at 1:30 in the morning?
He's extremely cool and very humble, very humble. I said, why are we here? And this was the big purpose question. And I reflected back on the story of the Bhagavad Gita, which I read to him when he was like 7 years old. And the Bhagavad Gita from the tantric interpretation, because it's all interpretation when you read these old ancient yogic texts. In the Bhagavad Gita, at the very end, Krishna, who's the charioteer, says to his friend Arjuna, who doesn't want to move on and make a decision in his life. He says, you know, there are no bad decisions, but whatever you do, do it because you love me. In other words, let love be the reason that trumps all reason. Mm. So when he said, why are we here? And this is the final words in my book. We're here to love. This is our collective purpose. And then how we deliver that purpose in the world is our unique way of showing up. But if we do it all with a sense of purpose, what would the world be like if we all embodied, remembered, and breathed that we are here to love? Can we take down the defenses? Can we take down the barriers? Can we stop the wars inside our own minds, the wars inside our families, the wars around the world, and remember that we're here to love? And that's why chapter 13 is called You or Me, Lovingly Disguised as You.
I am just so grateful for this conversation. I have just tears in my eyes, and thank you for vulnerably sharing and sharing these hard parts of life. And that's what I found so beautiful in your writing, is that ability to share, because in reality, that is what connects us and helps us when we can see ourselves and other people's stories and feel a little less alone. Mm-hmm. So thank you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you have time
an honor.
Do you have time for a couple of rapid fire questions?
I sure do. I'm excited.
I want to know this. I really want to know from you. What's your favorite book?
I have many favorite books. The series Conversations with God really speaks to me. Anything by Wayne Dyer. And what I'm reading currently is Dare to Lead by Brené Brown. And I'm bringing some of those concepts into my leadership consulting trainings.
Oh, love that. All of those. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so that's what you're currently reading right now as well. Mm-hmm. What's one thing you know for sure?
That we're all miracles.
Mm.
And when the life gets tough, and we project and we defend and we fight, it's because we've forgotten not only that we're a miracle, but the other is also a miracle. And this is science-based, by the way. If you read the book, you'll hear the research.
Is there a favorite quote or poem you'd like to leave us with?
The quote that really changed my life that I read in about 2008 maybe was Wayne Dyer, "When you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change." So that's really the quote that changes our willingness to assign a different meaning to our lives. In terms of a poem, I'm in love with Rumi and in the Sufi poet Rumi. And our task is not to seek for love, but to seek for all the barriers that have been placed against it. Now, I think the quote is really, our task is not to seek for love, but to seek for all the barriers that you have against it. But I believe that the barriers were imposed on us. And so our job is to slowly start to soften and melt away and remove some of the barriers to see where we've placed them on ourselves, but also where others have placed them on us, that we don't have to hold them anymore. So those are probably my two favorites.
Mm. Wow. Thank you. We'll have links to all of Diana's information in the show notes. Her book is The Call to Freedom, Heal Your Pain, Awaken Your Loving Presence. Her website is dianalockett.com, and it's LOCKETT. And that's how she is also on Instagram. Is there anywhere else you would like people to connect with you?
Yeah, Instagram, it's Diana Lockett Coach. Facebook, it's DM Diana Marie, DM.Lockett. And I do kicking and screaming. My kids brought me into TikTok. And I do every day little 30 to 60 second nuggets of wisdom. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I'm talking about the research of that You're a Miracle, the research on unity consciousness. Sometimes I'm simply telling you that you're okay and it's okay not to be okay. Oh. Sometimes I'm giving conscious parenting tips. You know, it's all in the realm of communication and consciousness. And so if people want to find me on TikTok, it's also under Diana Lockett Coach.
Mm, love it. Well, thank you so, so much for this conversation. We're so grateful to have you here today.
Thank you. And if I can share one more thing I'd love to leave your readers with.
Yeah, please.
I've created a journal, an accompanied journal for the Call to Freedom. Mm. And if I can make that available for a free download for your audience. If they go to I think I sent you the bit.ly link with that, but they can also go to my website and receive it as a free download on my website at dianalockett.com. Mm. And it's a journal that from every chapter of the book, there are prompts to help you to awaken your freedom in your life. And it's always there, by the way. We just have to remember it.
Thank you so much for doing that. Thank you. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Until we meet again.
Until we meet again. Be well.
Thank you so much for tuning into the episode, and I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. If you're ready to dive deeper into your own emotional expedition, I invite you to join me in an intimate 8-week virtual book study of Brené Brown's Atlas of the Heart. And in case you're not quite ready to join the study, I wanted to share a free offering that I often suggest to people as a little bit of a compass to get them started on their emotional journey, the Meditation to Alleviate Stress. You can find the meditation and the book study linked below. I'm so grateful you're here. Thank you for listening. And if you loved this episode, will you please share it with a friend or two? Be sure to rate, review, and follow the show on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts so you're sure to never miss a single episode.
This podcast is part of the Sound Advice FM network. Sound Advice FM. Women's voices amplified.